Welcome back to the Surfacing Leaders Podcast, where you can come along with nuclear submarine officer, sought-after turnaround CEO, and founder of Lead with Purpose, Mark Kohler, as he tells the stories of leaders in unlikely places and the human spirit that drives us all to show us that anyone can learn to be a leader. And now, here's Mark Kohler.
What is the key to sustainable high performance? As the pace of work continues to increase, this question is more pertinent than ever. Human performance scientist James Hewitt has conducted work and research with some of the world's highest performing individuals and companies for over 15 years to find this answer. He pulls from his experience as a full-time racing cyclist and combines that with groundbreaking work and research that has been proven out on the Formula One tracks and Fortune 500 companies all over the world. James's thought-provoking keynotes, high-impact consulting, and science-based messages have impacted audiences and organizations in over 30 countries, including aerospace, technology, finance, consulting, and pharmaceuticals. He's also been invited to speak at leading business schools such as IMD, St. Gallen, and he's presented at three World Economic Forum annual meetings in Davos. James, welcome to the Surfacing Leaders Podcast.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Mark.
Let's learn about who James is. Let's talk about where you were born and bring us up to today.
Sure. Let's dive into it. So I was born many years ago in England, but actually we moved to the States not long after that. So I spent the first few years of my life living in Shreveport, Louisiana, all places, with my dad's job related to pharmaceuticals. We moved back to the UK and, you know, had fairly conventional education, but I've always been fascinated with things that go fast. And during our time in the States, it was, you know, the glory days of the space shuttle. And so, you know, I watched those launches and was just fascinated by space and what human beings are capable of. And that really just sparked this fascination with things that go fast and what I'd now describe as human performance, even though obviously I didn't have those words to describe that back then. So I found myself attracted to various different types of sports, but in particular endurance sports with wheels, and eventually ended up getting into cycling, and I found I was pretty good at it. So I raced as a junior and then got onto a pretty good junior team in the UK, and then in my first year in this under 23 category had the opportunity to go and race in France, but a regional team. And so I did that for a summer, came back to start my degree at university in sports science. But then the team that I raced for said, you know, James, if you want to, you can come out here and race for us. We'll give you somewhere to live. And I'd had this dream emerging, this idea that maybe I could make a career as a professional cyclist. So when this opportunity arose, I made the decision to move to France to go all in to pursue this dream of becoming a professional cyclist. And I spent a few years doing that. It was an incredible opportunity. I moved through different teams. I got to race full time for a development team for one of the top pro teams at that time. But that was a really transformative experience in several ways. This was the early 2000s. The sport was going through a lot of challenges. To be frank, performance-enhancing drug use was rife. And I made a decision quite early on that I wasn't going to go down that track for a variety of reasons. But one being, I had a teammate who was arrested as part of a doping scandal. Our house got raided. We got arrested as part of that. And I realized that I definitely didn't want to go to prison. So that was a strong disincentive. But that, combined with the fact that I realized I wasn't really the most talented athlete, led me to be a very early adopter of different technologies. Things like power meters and heart rate monitors that I'm sure many of your listeners will be familiar with. But also started to try and understand how I could apply emerging science and published academic research to optimize my physical training and to try and make the most of my potential. And through that, people started to approach me for advice. I wouldn't even call it coaching. People were just curious. You know, how did I use these power meters and integrate those data into my training program, for example? And over the years, you know, I came to realize that I actually really enjoyed this process of applying science to realize my potential and help other people. So in the end, I had a very pragmatic view at my, what we call the palmares, your list of results. And it was apparent that I wasn't going to be a great pro cyclist. So I made the decision to retire, move back to the UK. I studied sports science, resumed those studies, and eventually ended up setting up my own coaching business. like many failed athletes do. But the people that I worked with, some were elite and professional endurance athletes, but the vast majority of my clients were what I describe as knowledge workers. So these were management consultants, finance professionals in London, where I was based at the time, who had very successful careers, often requiring them to work 60 hours a week. And outside of that incredibly intense work, they also decided to pursue these very challenging cycling events. And during this time, three important things happened. The first was that I became fascinated with the work that they were doing, because I realized that unless I could quantify what was going on during their very demanding work days, then it wasn't possible for me to plan their physical training effectively. This led me to a second revelation, which was that I realized I could start to apply these tools and frameworks from sports science, where I was trained, to try and understand knowledge work, work where we think for a living, better. And so thinking about principles like periodization, focusing on different things at different times, so that at the end of a longer period, you've actually developed the capacities that you need, for example. And then applying tools like heart rate variability to understand psychological load as well as physiological load. And this led to what felt like another revelation at the time, which was that I could view knowledge work, where we think for a living, as a cognitive endurance activity in a similar way that you might think about cycling as a physical endurance activity. And that's inspired a lot of my work and research to this day. So I ended up taking some of those learnings and going to work for a human performance company in Switzerland, and spent several years helping them to grow that business, translating learnings from the world of sports into a corporate context while continuing to work with athletes. So I ended up having the privilege to work quite extensively in Formula One with drivers and teams, as well as with some great companies. And so sometimes, you know, use this phrase from Formula One to Fortune 500, which has got a nice bit of alliteration. But this was a real formative experience for me to be able to work with these high performers in many different contexts and hone this understanding of how we can achieve sustainable high performance in knowledge work and translate these learnings from different high performance contexts. But along the way, I realized that there were still these unanswered questions. And to be honest, I felt like I had unfinished business with academia. Because while I was talking about knowledge work as an endurance activity, it wasn't clear to me that we really understood how to measure it, how to predict what was either supporting or inhibiting sustainable performance. And while there was some good work already ongoing, I really wanted to try and create a more robust kind of academic framework to support what I was talking about, what I was thinking about, and the work that I was doing. So I made the decision to go back to university to do a PhD. And ended up leaving the company that I was with to focus more intently on that, and funded my way through that PhD by keynote speaking, communication, and I'm actually about to submit my thesis for that PhD. So it'd be fantastic to have that process come to a conclusion fairly soon. So today, basically, I describe what I do in three pillars. I'm a performance scientist. There's a communication pillar, which is characterized by keynotes and workshops that I deliver for a range of clients, businesses all over the world. There's a consulting pillar, which is about translating those ideas from those keynotes and communication into practice within organizations. And then the third pillar is the research, which has been expressed by my PhD, but will continue with adjunct positions as I continue to generate papers and new data. And then obviously we came into contact with each other and had some great conversations already. But hopefully that kind of brings you up to date and gives a bit of context for your listeners.
I think, you know, when I think about that time, I don't know if it was pre-Lance Armstrong or not, but I mean, I was so bought into that. And then, you know, the big lie about it. And, you know, it was like, oh my gosh, came back. And he was so convincing, you know, during that time. But, you know, it's interesting. You're definitely one of the early people that looked at this psychological, you know, piece and the mind of it. You know, a lot of times we just think, oh, like Jerry Rice, well, he used to catch bricks, you know, you know, or David Beckham was outside, you know, in his front yard, just like kicking the ball. But there was a underlying probably mindset shift that was happening inside of them also versus just the technical aspects of the performance. And it's interesting, you know, all of the experience that you've had and how you've taken it and really, I think we all understand, like, hey, if you want to get better at running, like you have to have some type of intent. You have to have do this, you know, multiple times a week, and then you'll start seeing results. You can't just do it, you know, run once and go like, oh, I'm going to run a 6-minute mile and, you know, run once a month. And so I think it's really interesting that you've taken this, you know, mindset shift really early on, because no one was wearing heart rate monitors like in a lot of those. Now you see it all the time, right? Person takes off their shirt after they're done playing a soccer game. You see the heart rate monitor on it. Even Anya, who was just on, they tracked everything. I mean, the stat sheet that they had. It was interesting. You've taken that now to the mental aspect, and where's everything going in business? It's going more towards knowledge work. And so I think it's absolutely fascinating what you've been able to do. And the other thing is, if you ever get to see, we'll include some videos down below. If you ever get to see James, what he does this really unique thing where he actually wears, is it an fMRI? I don't know what it's called. Is it a, what's
so
the thing?
It's a brain imaging device. So it's called an EEG headset. So it relies on a technique called electroencephalography, which basically detects the electrical activity on your scalp, which is inferring the activity of your brain underneath that. So you can get a sense of particularly different brainwave frequencies that help us understand different brain states and how we might be responding to our environment, for example. So trying to bring some of this theory into life. And we can talk about why that's helpful and what that means practically, if that's, useful.
Let's go there right now. And because I think it's just a unique way. We can talk about certain things, but some people want to go like, hey, I want to see inside the hood. And you actually have your brain up on there. What's been the impact?
Yeah, so I think we've all experienced what I'd describe as always on work. I think it's one of the biggest challenges of the workplace today. So for me, always on work is characterized by this erosion of boundaries between work and home life, by working hours extending beyond what we describe as normal working hours, which is typically from kind of 8 or 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. in the evening. And there's also been this huge increase in what's described as after hours work. So some data indicate that after hours work is up by 28%. So that might be working in the evening. So what used to be a typical working day that might end at kind of 6, you know, now we might get home, maybe do something with the family or friends or pets or whatever. And then we start this new night shift of work in the evening. Now, this kind of always on work isn't necessarily a bad thing. In many ways, it's facilitated flexibility. It's more accommodating to different ways of living and working. But it has also really extended working hours and made it very difficult to experience a sense of mental distance from work. And in particular, it means that we take very few breaks relative to what we used to. And this shift to remote working has also played a role in this, because you might have had in-person meetings and then maybe walked between meeting rooms. You had a commute into the office, for example, and many people now are finding increasingly that they're sitting in front of these cameras on their computer for longer and longer amounts of time every single day. Now, there's some other data from Microsoft, which is quite interesting because obviously they've got access to this huge pool of data from all the people who use their Office Suite software. And some of their data indicate that the number of weekly meetings has increased by 153% over the last couple of years.
Wow.
So our days are more intense, they're longer, we've sometimes got fewer breaks. And the challenge is, you know, we're all talking about how, you know, artificial intelligence might be replacing our roles, you know, the machines are coming for our jobs. But my contention is that the real risk isn't that machines are going to keep working increasingly like humans. It's that we humans will keep trying to work like machines in this very intense, always on way, which actually isn't aligned with how our brains or bodies work. So I use these technologies, like this EEG headset, for example, to illustrate what is going on at what I describe as a neurophysiological level. So that's actually related to the activity of the physical structure of our brain. For example, what happens when we take a break between meetings versus when we don't? So I mentioned a moment ago that, you know, I've been measuring the electrical activity of my brain. And so the way that we characterize that electrical activity is often in frequencies. It goes through a transformation process statistically, and we end up with these frequency bands. And there's several of them, but one that's quite insightful, which illustrates this point about why breaks between meetings are important, relates to a brainwave frequency band called beta frequencies. And we can actually split this beta frequency band into two, kind of a high and a low beta. And so what you see is that when people are in kind of this high beta kind of segment of that frequency band, that brain activity is more associated with stress, with negative stress, whereas the lower section of that band is more associated with engagement. And actually, those bands are differentiated by how fast those frequencies are. Oh, wow. And what you see is that when people take a break between meetings, during the meetings, they're more likely to be in this low part of that beta brainwave frequency band. When they don't take a break between meetings, you'll see that they're more likely to be in this high beta band. So rather than being engaged, they're more likely to feel anxious. We actually see some other activity as well called transient hypofrontality and some shifts in that, which, you know, which can be associated with, you know, flow states. And we can also see kind of other activity in our brain, which can give us a sense of whether people are in a more optimal state for concentration, focus, for different types of activity versus maybe feeling more stressed, less engaged. But the bottom line is that when we take breaks between meetings, we're actually shifting our brain activity in such a way that we're more likely to be present, that the quality of our engagement is likely to be higher, and we're also less likely to experience this negative stress. Now, people have probably just felt this intuitively. It makes sense, doesn't it? But the beauty of being able to quantify it with these technologies and actually put a number to it is A, that we can start to test interventions and quantify the effects. So we can say that when we try this thing, this is more or less effective for a group, but maybe for individuals. But also, I think there's a credibility piece here as well, because a lot of people are talking about, you know, well-being and improving well-being. Right. And particularly for very driven people in incredibly high-performing, demanding environments where, you know, if it's something like Formula One, huge results are on the line. If we think about a commercial context, you know, there's a real economic impact. You can't just make decisions based on intuition. Even though intuition can be helpful, it's really useful to have some empirical data, something measurable to say, we recommend you taking breaks between meetings of this duration because we can actually suggest that there's going to be a meaningful, measurable impact. And you can see some evidence for this. There's a great case study that was published where they reduced the number of meetings actually in a company by 20%. And reducing a number of meetings by 20% actually significantly improved productivity. So it improved it by about 35%, I think, and actually reduced stress by over 20% by optimizing the meetings that they had. So they needed fewer. There's other studies. There's a case study which talks about how a particular CEO improved his ability to be present in meetings. And as a consequence of that, was able to reduce the number of meetings by over 20% because the quality of those meetings improved. And so I think, you know, many of us struggle with this always on way of work. And one of the reasons I use these tools is to try and provide data to help people to be clearer about when to focus effort and how to take effective rest. But the fundamental message is, how do we start to shift towards emphasizing quality over quantity in knowledge work? And these tools can help us to do that by providing those feedback loops to really figure out what's working well and maybe what do we need to get rid of.
I just share with you, I was thinking of when, you know, I'm giving a talk to someone, you know, and if it's, you know, I'll do a workshop and in the workshop, you like, I can tell now, like I am just, they just hear Charlie Brown's teacher. Like, wah, wah, wah. Even though I might be saying something that's like, you know, so valuable, but I've learned that, you know, anything like over like 50 minutes when I'm talking, it's really good just to give it 10 minutes. That's what I do, but I'm doing that based off of gut instinct of the audience. Mm. Are there any general guidelines that you can give us that are like, hey, meeting should be no longer than this, and then there should be some type of break? Any guidelines there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, in terms of meeting duration, I often encourage people to reset their default meeting duration to either 25 minutes or 50 minutes rather than 30 or 60, because it creates this buffer period where you can take a break. There's this body of literature about something called micro breaks. A micro breaks basically is a fancy way of saying short breaks. And the data in those literature would suggest that optimally a micro break should be about 10 minutes long. But the more cognitively demanding the activity is, the longer the break it generally needs to be. But actually 5 or 10 minutes can be still really effective. So as a rule of thumb, I'd say set your meetings as 25 minutes or 50 minutes rather than 30 or 60. And then when you take these micro breaks, I'd suggest that you try and create a break that has got at least one of the following characteristics. It's either relaxing, social, active, or natural. And ideally, it combines those characteristics. Relaxing means that you will experience a decrease in cognitive load. So you're doing something where you feel that your brain actually gets to slow down. And again, neurophysiologically, we'd see this shift into these slower brainwave frequencies during that break. There's this decrease in how hard your brain is working. The second characteristic is this social component. So it seems that when we connect with people about non-work related topics, then that is particularly restorative. And that can even just be sending a text message, for example. There's a number of reasons why this could be. So it can act as a distraction, but there's also a really interesting phenomenon called the social facilitation effect. And that describes how when we connect with people, even virtually, then we actually perceive subsequent challenges as less severe, as less challenging. And so some of the foundational research for this has illustrated how if people even think of a supportive person, then they perceive the gradient of slopes as less severe. They see it as, they perceive it as less steep.
That's awesome.
And, you know, this is, it's really interesting because the first time this was observed was back in 2008, so quite a long time ago. And it's in a kind of domain of research called social psychology. And subsequently, there was something called the replication crisis, because basically there were all these curious phenomena which had been observed, which when they tried to repeat the experiments, they weren't repeatable. And actually, there were some issues with how the experiments were conducted. But the nice thing about this social facilitation effect is that they've replicated this quite recently in the last couple of years, and it does replicate. It seems to be a kind of real and robust effect. So a micro break is relaxing, decreasing cognitive load. Micro break ideally has a social component, which might even just be sending a text, quick call, even just thinking of a supportive person potentially. The third characteristic is that an ideal micro break is active. Now, this takes advantage of the fact that about 80% of our brain's gray matter is modifiable by physical activity. One of the most powerful things we can do.
Really?
Yeah. So they've done some really interesting kind of neuroimaging studies. So many different studies. And if you were they did a review paper, which basically integrated the findings of these studies and came up with this estimation that about 80% of the brain's gray matter is modifiable by physical activity. And there's all kinds of evidence that illustrates this. And one study in particular that's quite illustrative of this point is that when we engage in physical activity, even just for 10, 15 minutes, go for a vigorous walk or a jog or a cycle, it seems to bias part of our brain called the amygdala, which sometimes we describe as the stress and fear center of the brain, towards feelings of happiness and away from fear. So there's this kind of stress buffering effect. There's this whole body of research called the cross-stressor hypothesis as well, which describes how the kind of this sympathetic nervous system activation we get. So the sympathetic nervous system is our fight or flight nervous system. And so when we are physically active, we have this increase in sympathetic nervous system activity. But over time, we get used to that. We adapt to it. And that means then that when we get stressed in other contexts, even if it's a psychological stressor, we become more adaptable to that same, to that our sympathetic nervous system basically is less reactive. We're more likely to respond healthily to that stressor. So physical activity, and I could cite tons and tons of literature. I mean, there's also some interesting evidence that even 2.5 hours of moderate intensity physical activity each week can reduce the risk of depression by about 18%. And so, you know, two and a half hours over a week of kind of, you know, going for a brisk walk is not a lot. So the bottom line is, you know, we sit for a long time. We're very sedentary. The flip side of this is that if you are sedentary for more than 3 hours each day, it increases the likelihood of you experiencing high levels of negative stress by more than 300%. So
say that again.
If people want to dig into the references, I can send the links to the references.
References is okay.
If we're sedentary for greater than 3 hours per day, it increases the risk that we'll experience negative stress or high levels of negative stress by over 300%.
Wow.
Because again, it seems that being sedentary, sitting for long periods, is not good for us psychologically or in terms of our body, our physiology and metabolism as well. So break up your day with even brief, what I call exercise snacks. I stole that from someone else. There was a study done in 2019 that came up with that name, but I call it an exercise snack or snacktivity, because you'd be amazed at how even these small, what we call bouts, so small activity sessions, really accumulate to have a positive effect. So when you have that, your 25 minute meeting instead of the half an hour meeting, you could just go and like run up some stairs for 2 minutes, and that's going to have a measurable positive impact, not only on the meeting or the work session you do afterwards, but also it'll accumulate over time to have a really positive effect. And there's some great research on exercise snacks. They did a study where they got a group of people 3 times a day, 3 days per week for 6 weeks. They got them to get up from their desk, go to the stairwell in their office, run up and down the stairs 3 times. It's about 2 minutes of activity, and back to their desk. So 3 times a day, morning, around lunchtime, afternoon, 3 days per week, say Monday, Wednesday, Friday for 6 weeks. And that simple activity session increased the average VO2 max in that group by 5%. And VO2 max is a measure of how much oxygen your body can take up and use. It's a really important biomarker that is an index, a window into the energy we have for everything, as well as our health span. So how long we're likely to live healthily for, which is the thing that many of us are really aiming for. So an active micro break is key. The final characteristic is that ideally a micro break will have some kind of natural component. And so by that, I mean, you get some kind of exposure to nature. And so that could be as simple as looking at the clouds in the sky, leaves on the tree. If you buy the water, that would be ideal. Because when we see natural, what's called fractal patterns, and that's what you see in clouds, leaves, waves, for example, breaking on a beach, that elicits a unique pattern of brain activity, which seems to be associated with restoration. We relax, we recover, our stress levels drop. And they found, one study found that even looking at a forest scene, an artificial forest scene, like a video basically, for 10 minutes was associated with measurable reductions in perceived stress, perceived negative stress. So if you can mix those together, so imagine a scenario where, you know, you've got a 50 minute meeting and you have a 10 minute break, and you and some of your colleagues go for a walk together, talk about something non-work related. So you've got this decrease, this relaxation, decrease in cognitive load. There's a social component. There's an active component because you're walking, ideally outside. So there's that natural component. That would be, they'd be my top tips to optimize those micro breaks. And I think there's a really solid evidence base to suggest that that would be the right thing to do for your well-being and also for your performance.
Yeah, you know, we complicate this. We complicate all these things, right? I got to work out for 3 hours a day and all this stuff. And we find out that, you know, hey, working's out not for me. When you break it down to that simple, if you can't do that, you know, feel and see the benefits. You know, it's interesting, you know, what I'll do is I will tell them to get up and get outside. And this is, and the only thing I've done is, this is just based upon when people have the 10 minute break and they sit there and they stay in their phone and they're texting, you know, their company and everything. Not like, hey, I'm grateful for you, but hey, did you get the proposal out?
Yeah.
And so I do that. And the other thing I do is music, some type of music.
Oh, great.
That just sort of like, you know, just turn it on for like 10 minutes and then obviously make sure that they come back. I love all this stuff with the foundation and I'm a huge stats guy. So I love that you're backing it up. A lot of this stuff is just, it's common knowledge, you know, it's like as old as the hills, but when people actually see it, I think it's really, really powerful. Let's talk about knowledge as an endurance activity. You and I had a conversation the other day and we were talking about some of the misconceptions that are around, you know, resilience and fragility and all those things. So I'd like you to, I thought that was a really powerful conversation that we were on. I'd love to dive deeper into that, but why don't you set us up for that?
Yeah, no, happy to. Because I think, you know, we often talk about, we throw around these terms like resilience all the time. And sometimes we might say that something's robust. There's also this notion of anti-fragility kind of emerging as well. But I think it's really helpful to be clear about what these terms mean, because I think they really they set out a roadmap for what we're really hoping to achieve. So I think the challenge with resilience really is that what we're saying is that people will experience something, they'll get broken down a bit, and then they're going to bounce back. That's great on one level. And that's what we call resilience. Something being robust, technically, will be that people experience some kind of challenge. Clinically, you would call it an insult. But actually, they're not changed. They're kind of robust enough. It just bounces off. But then we've got this notion of anti-fragility, which is that people can experience challenge. They can experience uncertainty. And instead of being broken down and then just coming back to the level that they're at before, they can actually grow stronger. They can actually develop through it. And you know, sometimes I think it's helpful to think about a metaphor to describe this principle. And one way to think about it is that if you were to get a tea candle, like one of these small candles, and light it and place it on a table outside in a garden, and imagine that a gentle breeze blows across the garden, that flame in the tea candle would be immediately extinguished because the candle is fragile. We could try and make that candle robust, so unchangeable. And so to do that, we might get like a storm lantern, for example, and you put that storm lantern on the table, put the tea candle inside it, relight it. And then when the breeze blows across the garden, the tea candle is protected, it's robust. And often when we think about kind of well-being programs and trying to look after people, that's kind of what we're trying to do in an organizational context. We want to kind of wrap them up and protect them. But my argument is that ideally we want to help people to become anti-fragile. And the metaphor for anti-fragility is rather than a tea candle or a storm lantern, we build a fire pit. So, you know, a fire pit in the garden, we stack up logs, we set fire to it. And then that gentle breeze, instead of blowing out that flame, it will actually bring oxygen to that fire and increase its intensity. And eventually it's bringing light and warmth to that entire garden. And so you can look at anti-fragility, you say, well, what are the foundation stones for that fire pit for establishing anti-fragility? And there's a number. I mean, one of the things that you do need is energy. You know, metaphorically in that fire pit, there's a lot of logs there. And so we need to make sure that people are doing things that are recharging them, that are helping them to build the energetic capacity to grow through challenge rather than just bounce back from it or be harmed by it. But we also need to think about the environment around it, how those logs are constructed. And that's where we've got principles like psychological safety, for example, so that people feel able to be honest about mistakes, be honest about challenges, to bring their ideas and actually then grow through this process of experimentation and sometimes failure rather than fearing it and trying to hide away from it. But I do think it's helpful when we're thinking about sustainable performance, and particularly when we're talking about knowledge work as an endurance activity, that we're clear that ideally we want to establish anti-fragile performance. Because as I mentioned at the beginning, if we think about, you know, this metaphor of knowledge work as an endurance activity, similar to cycling as a physical endurance activity, when you're training someone, when you're doing training sessions, the idea isn't that, you know, you do a training session and it tires you out and then you recover enough so you can do the same training session again. You know, the idea actually is that you train, you're tired, you recover. And then actually that same training session eventually is too easy. So you increase the demands over time, you build capacity, your performance improves. And obviously there's a limit. This isn't just a kind of a get out of jail free card for companies to just load more and more and more pressure on people. But actually my argument is that I think sometimes we make there's a risk with well-being strategy that rather than promoting anti-fragility, we reinforce fragility. So we try and wrap people up in cotton wool rather than saying to them, look, we're going to create the conditions where you can really reach your full potential. And it's not always going to be comfortable, but if you want to come on this journey with us together, we can be more. And I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions about psychological safety. And Amy Edmondson, who really kind of coined that term and is responsible for doing a lot of the research into it, is quite clear about that. You know, psychological safety doesn't mean that we're never uncomfortable. Quite the opposite, right? Because growth and actually being honest about mistakes, which is a significant part of growth and innovation, for example, in companies, isn't comfortable. But if we can do it in a way where failure is framed as an opportunity to learn, where we isolate the problem, not the person, And we develop a culture where people can come with their ideas, they can come with the problems, their failures, and together we can grow through that and build on it. I really think it's possible to establish anti-fragile performance at both an individual and a team level, and for it to be sustainable then, which is that kind of key of knowledge work being an endurance activity. And there's other different aspects we can talk about underneath that umbrella term. But you know, that's one way to think about it in the context of fragility, resilience, robustness, and anti-fragility, and the distinction between those four components.
You know, when we were talking the other day and you said anti-fragility, I was like, oh, that's a negative term. And because I was trying to, you know, and it's just because I don't really know the term, right? And so it was just interesting. I love the way you've described it for us so that we all are on the same page. What is the biggest thing that leaders are getting wrong today as it relates to establishing an environment where people can, you know, get to anti-fragility?
That's a big question.
That's a big question. What's the number one thing then, say?
Yeah. So I think the number one thing is that leaders aren't clear about how to balance their own and their employees' relationship between effort and recovery. So I think that is the fundamental problem. And again, I think that goes back to this always on work. And I think because leaders often don't realize the effect that their own relationship with effort and recovery ends up cascading down to other people. You know, there's some crazy research that suggests that leaders have a greater impact on their team's well-being than spouses, doctors, or therapists. So as a leader, you have a huge impact on the people who work for you. Absolutely enormous. And it kind of makes sense if you think about, you know, how much time do you spend with your spouse or partner relative to your boss, or at least kind of working in an environment where they represent the authority figure or the main person in that mix. It's probably more. And so I think that the way this relates to effort recovery is how, for example, our sleep plays into how we behave as leaders, and also the effect that has on our teams, and what that's doing in terms of diminishing people's energy and also shifting how they make decisions, which is more likely to promote fragility rather than anti-fragility. So to give you a concrete example of that, there's some really interesting research by a guy called Christopher Barnes, and he is a sleep researcher, but looks a lot at the relationship between sleep and various factors related to leadership and our behavior. And so he did a really interesting piece of research where they restricted leaders' sleep to either 5 hours per night or 7 hours per night. And then looked at the effect that had on how how employees perceived how inspirational the leader was. And so what they found was that when leaders slept for 5 hours per night versus seven, they were consistently rated as less inspirational by the people who they were leading. And that's an interesting one, because sometimes we might say, well, that's a shame, but is it a really big deal? Well, there's some other complementary research that indicates that an inspired employee is 225% more productive than an employee who's merely satisfied in their job. So inspiration is this huge multiplier in terms of the effect that it can have on people's productivity, with a real measurable impact on output, which is going to translate into dollars at the end of the day. There's also some perhaps more concerning research which indicates that when leaders exhibit what's called sleep devaluing behavior, so that might mean they don't sleep enough, they don't promote sleeping adequately, which means at least 7 hours per night, then their team members, their subordinates, are more likely to make less ethical decisions. And it seems that the mechanism that describes that is actually that subordinates don't end up sleeping enough, their sleep quality is impaired. And we know consistently that when we don't sleep enough, that impairs our self-regulation. Now, we've probably, again, it's all very intuitive stuff, but if you've not slept very well, we're generally not our best selves. We're more likely to make poor decisions. We're more likely to, for example, snap at a loved one or a colleague rather than be self-controlled and maybe take a moment, take a breath and think about whether that's the best way to respond. And so, again, there's this balance between effort and recovery. So leaders who are not sleeping adequately, i.e. too much effort, not enough recovery, are then less likely to be inspirational. So teams are less likely to have that energy that they get from an inspirational leader to go and find those ideas to grow. They also feel less safe. There was some interesting unpublished research which suggests that when leaders' sleep quality is impaired, then, or and actually particularly related to their sleep debt, when leaders have a higher level of sleep debt, their teams rate the environment as less psychologically safe. And so if a leader doesn't sleep enough, and that's probably, again, related to the fact that their socio-emotional processing is impaired. And so as a result, are they going to bring those ideas? Are they going to admit to their mistakes and their failures? Very likely not. You know, sleep is so crucial for emotional processing that some researchers have characterized it as nighttime therapy. And there's a when we sleep in two phases. There's it's a bit of an oversimplification, but there's non-REM sleep, which we call deep sleep, and REM sleep, which we call rapid eye movement sleep. And it seems that this rapid eye movement sleep is particularly important for the processing of social emotions. And when you selectively shorten or restrict this REM sleep, then people become much more emotionally reactive and less able to process social emotion. So you can see the scenario where a leader's not sleeping enough, then their team isn't sleeping enough, and you're much more likely to promote an environment that at worst is fragile. Bad things happen and people get broken down. At best, it might be resilient. People experience some kind of challenge and then eventually manage to bounce back. But it's very unlikely you're going to develop this anti-fragile performance environment where people are going to experience challenge and uncertainty and grow stronger through it. And again, that would be my reasoning behind saying that the number one challenge is that leaders are getting this balance between effort and recovery wrong. And actually, you know, according to the data, some data, more than 60% of leaders are not sleeping enough on at least four nights per week. And the vast majority of leaders are dissatisfied with how much sleep they're getting. So we might not be thinking about it, but it's often more important than we think.
Yeah, wow. And you know, we understand all of these things. Like the car has only a certain amount of gas in it. Mm. It's not going to run forever. And so we have to stop and we have to fill it up with gas. You know, we know that athletes, you know, even the highest endurance athletes, you know, their body breaks down. We've seen this when they, you know, come to the end of an Ironman, and you know they're crawling towards the finish line. Their mind is still, but the you know everything else is you know broken down, and it's interesting that we don't do enough to, and I'm just reflecting upon myself, James. Like we have a daily meeting. And so we'll just say, hey, what's my vision for today? Like what top three things I'm going to do today? And you know, I'll say, hey, I'm going to continue working, you know, and I'm just giving the team an update. Like, hey, I worked till like 1 o'clock last night. And I really got the keynote dialed in for, you know, adjusting it. And the negative, and it's not intentional that I'm wanting them to do that, but it's probably they're going like, oh, if Mark's doing that, like maybe that's expected of me. You know, so it could be a negative, you know, outcome of just being able to be able to say that. And I know I'm not my best self when I only get 5 hours of sleep and multiple times, you know, and I heard someone say, if you don't schedule the alignment for your car will schedule the alignment for you. And that's the same with sleep. You know, if you don't get enough sleep, your body will definitely do that for you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk to us about, I'm interested. I'm just going to share with you what I experienced in the submarine force. We were on, you know, we were in high stress environment. It was 24/7, you know, underneath it was like, you know, hey, we're 400 feet below the surface of the ocean. So there was this underlying stress that we never really talked about with each other, but it was always there. And the other thing is we were on 18-hour days because we were very much, it was a very sedentary, like there was no workout facility. There was no bike you could sit on. There was no, hey, I'm going to go clear my head. And it was this very sedentary. What they found is that submariners gain on average 10 pounds during missions. Wow. And it's just because the only thing we have to look forward to is the meal. That was the only connection back. But I'd love your thoughts because we were on 3 6-hour watches, and people go like, well, why'd you do 3 6-hour watches? Like that screws up your circadian rhythm and then your sleep. And just the way it worked when you were training yourself, when you're trying to qualify, when you're running your division, James, we were getting probably 3 to 4 hours of sleep on 18 hours. And then in those 3 to 4 hours, they might run a fire drill in the middle of it. And you literally just fell asleep like 12 minutes ago. I'd love your thoughts on what was going on for me and for others. I mean, it's not a Formula One environment, but it is a high performance environment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I find these extremes fascinating. And you know, what you've just described is one of the most extreme environments. I think that one of the challenges that we have, but which is also potentially adaptive in the environment you described, is we're actually very poor judges of how inadequate sleep affects us. And so when you've got no choice about having to perform in a sleep deprived state, ignorance is bliss. So it's probably a good thing that you don't realize, because if you've got no choice about doing that fire drill. So if you're doing it feeling absolutely awful because you're so aware of how impaired you are, that's not going to be a good thing. So actually this kind of inability to recognize how impaired we are for most of human history and in the extreme environments that you've described is probably quite adaptive. But there's no doubt that you are impaired, and there's various different cognitive abilities that are impaired to a different extent. So our ability to make complex decisions is probably going to be impaired. But that's why your training and all the drills that you did will have been so critical, because then that you basically create these subroutines, these automaticized sets of behaviors that mean that even though these kind of higher order cognitive functions are impaired, you can still deliver, you can still perform when you need to. And you see that in military contexts and other environments where that part of the reason that either consciously or intuitively we know that drilling people to be able to do things automatically, whether it's in your context, the drills that you'd need to respond to, even though you're sleep deprived, or in another military context with a warfighter who needs to, potentially disassemble and assemble their gun in complete darkness while sleep deprived and freezing cold. And it's amazing what the brain can do essentially automatically with very little conscious control. I think it's also amazing what humans can do for relatively brief periods in the context of their lifespan. So humans are very adaptable. And one of the reasons that our species has been able to endure and populate most of the planet is because we've got many systems that do enable us to still maintain performance, even in very suboptimal conditions. So, our sympathetic nervous system is able to ramp up and, for example, maintain levels of alertness and vigilance, even when we might be more sleep deprived, if we feel that there is a threat to our life. I think the challenge is that there's a cost. There's always a cost. And I'm not familiar with the submarine force, with submariners, but in other military contexts, it seems that there's potentially higher incidence of certain illnesses and diseases, which may have at least part of their root in continually disrupted circadian rhythms, for example. And so there's a cost. And so when I'm working with high performers, whether it was, if it's someone in a military context, more often for me, it would be someone in a sporting context, but also sometimes in a business context where it might be an investment banker who's sleeping 6 hours a night and flying transcontinentally several times a week. And I've worked with many people in that context. That isn't going to be entirely healthy. But what I always ask people is make sure that it's worth it. Make sure that your purpose behind this is worth it. Because sometimes in life, actually, it's worth doing things even though there is a high cost, even though it might not be optimal for our health. And we've talked about this before, this notion that performance isn't about creating optimal conditions. It's being able to do the job even when the conditions are against you, actually. Yeah. So I think the other element of this is when you've got a very demanding environment like you've described, you will end up selecting for the outliers. So we know, for example, that the vast majority of people need 7 hours of sleep to perform adequately. Below 7 hours of sleep, you start to see a breakdown in various different systems and deterioration in our cognitive performance and various aspects of our physiology as well. There are a tiny proportion of the population who've got a genetic polymorphism, a mutation on the DEC2 gene, which means that they can perform adequately on fewer than 7 hours per night. But they are very, very rare, even in a selective environment. I'd still expect there'd be very few people with that gene. But nonetheless, there are going to be people who are more resistant to those effects of inadequate sleep, who are able to turn it on when they really need to. And one of the things that fascinates me about these high performance environments is that you find these outliers, you find these unusual people. And sometimes there's something we can learn from them. Other times you just kind of shake your head and you say, well, they're kind of the exception that proves the rule. But they'd be some of my initial kind of reflections on that situation you described.
So when my wife listens to this, she's going to say, James said, yeah, you're a mutant, because she'll probably describe me having some other gene. When we would go anywhere, like I learned to fall asleep within like 10 seconds. Because when I got off watch and I knew we were going to run a drill, I would lay down in the wardroom, and what I would do is I would fall asleep. And if I got 8 minutes of sleep, like that was like, hey, that's a, you know, did I really get 8 minutes of sleep? I don't know. But it'd be funny. Mm-hmm. We'd be in an airport. My wife's, she's going, are you going to fall asleep? And there I am, I'm already asleep. And yeah, I've lost that a little bit, but it was a very challenging environment, just not the stress of it, but no sunlight, you know, no fresh air, no workout facility. And then living in a cold steel tube, and you know, I'm 6'4" and the bunk was 6 foot. So it was very, very challenging, but definitely learned a lot. You know, we were playing three-dimensional chess, high stakes chess. And that was always, it was always an interesting game, but they'd done their own studies and found out that the seventh and eighth hour, massive problems in the engineering plant of making really poor decisions. I mean, like massive drop off. Yeah. And that's why they just said, hey, we're going to shift to that. One of the things people might be listening to right now is saying, hey, I've heard this thing about a morning routine, because that's me. Like, hey, I get up at, 4:30, I go do a workout, I get my praying in, so more sort of my spiritual, then I set my intentions for the day. Some people are just like, oh, like I can't get up. Are there different, is that real? I mean, is that real with people, or is it something we can learn? Talk to us about that, because some people might say, hey, I can't fall into that routine. I do stuff more at night or during the middle of the day. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So, I mean, people might have come across this notion of chronotypes before, and chronotypes describe our tendency towards morningness or eveningness, or maybe being somewhere in the middle. Right. And our chronotype is actually encoded genetically. So we genuinely have this tendency towards morningness, eveningness, or somewhere in the middle. And there's a number of different reasons why this might be. One is that every cell in our body has a clock, and that clock is almost 24 hours, but not quite. And so people who are stronger morning types might have a slightly different kind of offset relative to 24 hours than people who are more evening types. So someone with a kind of a more of an evening type might actually have a slightly kind of longer body clock, which means that, you know, when it gets to evening, they're just not quite so sleepy relative to someone with a kind of shorter body clock. There also might be this, it might be influenced by our tendency or our sensitivity to something called adenosine. So when we've been, when we're awake, there's an accumulation of a molecule in our brain called adenosine. And if you've done biology, you might have heard of like ATP, adenosine triphosphate, the energy currency of life. And through it's metabolized and you've got this adenosine that pops off. But basically, adenosine accumulates in our brain. And adenosine attaches to receptors in our brain, and it's actually responsible for this increase in what we call sleep pressure. And so I've got a sun time here, actually. So you can imagine that during the course of the day, we've got sleep pressure kind of increasing. It's kind of building up. Yeah. And when there's enough sleep pressure, we feel really sleepy towards the end of the day. And one of the reasons caffeine works, actually, is because you can imagine caffeine coating the inside of that sun timer. And so what it actually does is block the receptor sites for adenosine. And so we don't experience this increase in sleep pressure. So anyway, the reason this relates to morning routines is that people who are more sensitive to adenosine, perhaps they've got more adenosine receptors. This is kind of hypothetical, but these are proposed mechanisms. Yeah. That would mean that as that sun timer fills up during the day, I'm going to feel more sleep pressure if I am kind of someone who likes to go to bed early, for example. Right. And so whereas there's some people who might be less sensitive, who might be more of an evening type, because we might have the same amount of adenosine in there in the brain, but actually they're less sensitive to it. They feel less sleep pressure. So there's these two interacting systems. We've got this kind of the 24-hour cycle of the chronotype of the circadian clock, and then you've got this SAN timer, which is related to adenosine. And the interaction of those clocks and differences between them, between people, will create this tendency towards morningness or eveningness. That also changes over the lifespan. So over as we age. So for example, teenagers, right, they biologically become more late types.
Right.
And so there's a reason that teenagers are so hard to get up in the morning. Like my wife and I's eldest son is about to turn 13, and we feel this every day getting him up for school. And so if you are more naturally a morning type, who knows the reasons behind it? There's some proposed mechanisms. You'll naturally find it easier to get up in the morning. You'll feel more alert more quickly. And establishing a morning routine will probably be quite easy for you, or easier. Whereas if you're more of a strong late type, it can be really hard to establish that morning routine. So I think that it's important to recognize that it's not necessarily going to work for everybody. And so it might be more important for someone else to establish kind of a routine or a pattern at a different point in the day. So for someone who is a late type, you might have some kind of routine, some kind of pattern that helps you to achieve the things you want to achieve. Maybe it starts a bit later. Maybe it might even be something you do in the afternoon, for example. But the idea, the notion of having kind of some activities that are consistent day to day, I do think can be really helpful, because the challenge is all too often we try and rely on our self-control. And you know, the evidence is pretty clear that like human self-control is really unreliable. Right. And there's some really interesting research that indicates that actually the people who have the highest self-control, and it's actually a psychological construct you can measure, appear to use it the least day to day. They actually deploy that self-control before they need it to create systems, to create structures, to create routines, so that then when they're in the situation, they don't actually need it. And similar to those habits and routines and drills that we spoke about a moment ago. So I do recommend that people think about trying to structure their environment in a way that will support their goals, but that doesn't necessarily need to mean that they wake up at 4:30 a.m. every day. Even though for some people that might be a really helpful thing to do. And I've got some ideas about, you know, some things that are really helpful to include, and we can talk about that, but that'd be my kind of initial thoughts on in response to your question.
Well, I think it's good. I know there are some people who who are, you know, I think you described them as night owls. And and you know, it's better to, I think, to do what you want to do and make sure it gets done during the day versus like doing it and you're like, oh my gosh, this is horrible. Because then you just stop doing it. And I love, you know, you're talking about James Clear from Atomic Habits. You know, we don't rise to the level of our goals. We fall to the level of our systems and our habits. Tell us about your favorite story and what you learned in working in Formula One.
That's a great question. I mean, I had the privilege to work with some really interesting drivers and teams. The one that springs to mind is actually a conversation that I had with a guy called Nico Rosberg, who was a Formula One world champion and, you know, very famously was Lewis Hamilton's teammate. We had a really interesting conversation about many topics. One of the things we talked about was the fact that he won this Formula One world championship and then he retired immediately afterwards. So if you're not familiar with Formula One, look up his story. But we also had a really interesting conversation about fear. Because the thing about Formula One is, and one of the reasons that it fascinates me, is that it's a high-performance environment where people really are putting their life on the line. And we had this conversation where Nico was talking about his view and his experience of fear. And actually, his view was that fear isn't something that he tried to ignore or eliminate. He actually embraced it and felt that it was a fuel for him to reach his full potential, which ended up being expressed as him becoming Formula One world champion. And there's so many different threads that we could pull out of that conversation. But one of the reasons it really stood out to me was the fact that, you know, so often I think that we try and work against our natural inclinations rather than recognizing them and transforming them into something that is a force for good. And that conversation, that interaction that I had with him really brought that home to me, because he had such a clear outcome associated with that way of thinking. You know, he won the pinnacle of that competition, of that sport, Formula One. So, and I think there's lessons from that that apply equally well in a business context and in a life context as well, where, you know, often we try and resist what we're feeling. We try and push it away. We try and ignore it, but actually we can transform it. There's some really interesting research around stress mindset, for example, that illustrates how if we view stress as something that's harmful, then we experience very negative outcomes physiologically and psychologically associated with that experience of stress. But if we acknowledge the stress, so we don't try and ignore it, we acknowledge it, but then we try and reframe that experience of stress and turn it into a source of energy and activation to actually tackle the demands that are causing the stress in the first place, then we're able to not only improve our performance as a result of that, there's a measurably lower physiological response in terms of the negative physiological response we'd expect to see, which often is kind of indexed by something like cortisol, which we sometimes describe as a stress hormone, so lower levels of cortisol. So that of all the kind of conversations and interactions I've had and stories from Formula One, it's probably that conversation, just talking about having a true elite performer describe their experience of transforming something which often we'd like to avoid into a really powerful force to reach more of their potential. Unfortunately, that conversation was actually recorded. I can share a link if anyone's interested.
We'll put it in the link down below. As it relates to that, you know, I think it's on Netflix, the series.
Yeah.
I'm always just so fascinated by it, because I think it's just, it's probably a good example. And I think of, you know, people in sports from the 1950s. Mm. You know, they were like, yeah, I had training and then I had to go to work, you know, and they were playing professional baseball or weren't making any money. And you think about those times, like that just wouldn't work anymore with the level of just anything, the speed of play. And it doesn't matter what sport it's in and how it's been taken to a different level. And even Formula One, when we think about, when I watch that, you know, the driver's certainly in the car, but it is a team sport. I mean, if you,
absolutely,
yeah, you watch that. So I'd like you to talk about what are some of the key things that they do. I mean, I see the drivers are so humble. I mean, they're very, they want to win. Like they have this tremendous drive, but they are so humble with their team and know that they can't get by without their team. So I'd like you to talk about what's the environment Formula One as it relates to being an individual leader. You know, you have to have that individuality, but you also have to have a team.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the interesting things about Formula One is that some people say it's too much of a business to be a sport. It's too much of a sport to be a business. But fundamentally, a Formula One team is kind of a combination between kind of a sports team, software company, and a precision engineering factory.
Right, right.
Because, you know, they're building these cars. And one of the fascinating things is, you know, a Formula One season will see thousands of changes being made to these cars. And in many ways, the most successful teams are the teams that can kind of out-iterate their competitors. So they can go through more research and development cycles, so they can find the edge, they can optimize. And so that's why you'll see kind of, they'll talk about kind of, you know, bringing upgrades and these packages, which basically means that there's a load of things they've worked on and they're going to bolt them on the car and roll them out at one of the races. And so it's one of the reasons why it's so critical as well to have a car that performs well early in the season, because if you're very competitive early on, you can actually start to invest your time and resources into developing the next season's car rather than just trying to get on par with your competitors during that particular season. But if I was to put you on the spot and say, what is the average failure rate as a percentage in Formula One research and development cycles, what would you guess the percentage failure rate is?
On a percentage from like 0 to 100%?
Yeah, where 100% was 100% failure and zero is no failure at all. What you came up with worked straight away.
Like 70, 80%?
It's like 97%.
Wow.
So in these research and development cycles, it's continual failure. And so in many ways, I think that one of the lessons that we can take from these Formula One teams is that failure truly is framed as an opportunity to learn and grow.
Love it.
And I think there's a great example of this in the Mercedes AMG Petronas Formula One team. And the team principal is a guy called Toto Wolff. And you know, Toto Wolff is just an absolutely fascinating guy, because when he bought into the Mercedes team, he became team principal. He took, he got a bit of a discounted kind of price on the on some shares in that team. And if you just look at the financial performance of that team, it is incredible the value that he's created there. And he's a great leader. And I think he's got some great quotes around this as well. And one quote that he shared, which I think I shared earlier in the podcast, actually, it comes from Toto, is that they consistently isolate the problem, not the person. And so as a leader, I think there's so much that we can learn from that, where you know, this isn't about shirking responsibility, no, but it's about clearly identifying what the problem is and how as a team we can work together to overcome that and use that as this foundation for continuous improvement and growth. There's a model that's quite helpful actually in relation to this. It's called the three P's model. And it, the three P's stand for pervasiveness, permanence, and personalization. And the it's basically gives you a framework to ask some questions to help you to attribute success or failure in a more helpful way. And so the pervasiveness question is about asking yourself, is this something that's going to have a short-term impact or a really long-term impact, essentially? Mm-hmm. The pervasiveness question is about, is this going to have a really local impact? So does it affect a very small isolated thing or does it affect everything? And then the personalization question is about, you know, how much of this is my responsibility versus other people's? And what you find is that if you get the kind of the permanence question, does it affect just now or forever? And you get the pervasiveness question correct. It's calibrated correctly. So is this local or global? Often you get the personalization right, that balance between how much of this really is on me and how much really is on other people. Because I think the challenge is sometimes that we can miscalibrate those three elements. And as a result of that miscalibration, we end up creating team environments that are more likely to be fragile or perhaps resilient, but not going to be anti-fragile. And I'll give you an example of that, you know, in terms of this, the permanence and pervasiveness piece. So if you had a bad race and things didn't go right in a Formula One context, if you were to miscalibrate permanence, you'd just say, well, you know, we're screwed for the whole season.
Right.
You're basically saying that it's going to go on forever. Whereas, you know, the reality is it's like you had a bad race. What can we learn from this race? How can we make it different for the next race? Again, there's this pervasiveness. So you might say after a bad race, well, you know, we're just a terrible team, global, rather than saying, okay, what specifically went wrong? Localize it. Why was this race bad? Was it strategy? Was it a component failure? Was it a driver error? You know, and then let's work on trying to fix that. And related to that, around the personalization, as a team, when you're kind of going through this process, this kind of debrief, each person being honest about and saying, how much of this was my responsibility? How much was other people's? Because you mentioned that, you know, they're one of the characteristics of these drivers is that they are, many of them are very self-aware. The best drivers are very self-aware. And so sometimes you'll see journalists in the media giving drivers a hard time about this because, you know, they'll have a bad race and they'll, and you know, people say, oh, you know, they're blaming the car. They're just blaming the car. They should take responsibility. But what good is taking personal responsibility for something that's not your fault? If it genuinely is a problem with the car, you need to isolate the problem to the car and fix it. There's no point saying, oh, it was me. It's my fault. That needs to be calibrated acutely so that you can find the problem. You can work together as a team to overcome it. So I think, you know, that 3P model is really applicable in a Formula One context, in a business context, even in a life context. It's something that sometimes, you know, we talk about with our kids in a slightly less kind of academic way, obviously. But Formula One is a great example of how do you calibrate those three Ps and then use them to create this cycle of continuous improvement, because you can be really clear then about what you need to work on, who needs to work on it. But ideally in this environment of psychological safety, which as I mentioned before, is about the being freely able to share ideas. It's not about always feeling comfortable, because as I think many of us have probably can bring to mind examples of where we've had to be honest about the things that were our responsibility, mistakes have been made. It's not very nice, but if it's done in the right way, it can really build truly anti-fragile teams.
Well, where can people learn more about you or connect with you?
So I'm pretty active on LinkedIn, if people have got accounts there. And so I post a lot of this type of content. And I've also got an Instagram account, which isn't very active at the moment, but maybe I'll do a bit more on that this year. And I have a website, which is jameshewittperformance.com, where you can find out more. There's blogs there where we do deep dives on these topics. You can find out a bit more about my speaking communication. And there's also a newsletter that you can sign up for if you're interested. But would welcome the opportunity to connect with people and continue the conversation. If you know there's any topics you wanted to dig into in more detail or questions that maybe you've got or reflections, would love to hear from you.
Yeah, I think it's just so powerful what you're doing. And you were early on as, really the data and the science behind it. And look, you know, there's been a lot more technology that allows us to look into this blob that is, 3 pounds and, you know, whatever, uses so much energy of a light bulb.
Absolutely.
Or something like that. Yeah. So I think it's fantastic. We will include, those links down below so people can easily get to it. But James, I want to thank you so much for your time. I thought the conversation was just outstanding. The one thing that I take away from it is, and it's just, I think it's like anything in life, but you said it so many different times, is it's about being intentional. And it's about, you use these two words together. I don't know if you're going to trademark this, but you used effort and recovery. You never used one without the other. And mm-hmm. I think it's a strong thought that we should have in our own minds. We really understand the, athletes, but we mm-hmm. got to take that same to our mind. We have to take that same approach. So as it relates to effort and recovery, those two things are what drive high performance, and it would helps us to then have, cognitive endurance, but not have it be in conflict with well-being. So I want to thank you for being on the Servicing Leaders podcast. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. You summed that up so perfectly. It was a real privilege to speak with you.
Thanks for joining Mark today. And remember, new episodes of Servicing Leaders will be available every other week where you can become inspired, gain confidence, and learn leadership right where you are. Until next time, make it a great day.